A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about daydreaming. Specifically, do we all do it? What's actually happening in the mind when we drift off mid-task into some internal scene? And whether daydreaming shares anything with nighttime dreaming, or if they're fundamentally different mechanisms? He's pointing us toward the default mode network, the spectrum from idle mind, wandering to immersive fantasy, and individual variation. There's a lot to unpack here.
Honestly, this is one of those topics where the popular science has gotten so far ahead of the actual neuroscience that most people are walking around with a completely backwards model of what's happening in their own heads. The biggest misconception is that daydreaming is your brain slacking off, that it's a failure of attention, a cognitive idle state where nothing useful is happening. The metabolic data completely contradicts that. Your brain is about 2% of your body weight, but consumes roughly 20% of your energy, and when you shift into what looks like unfocused mind wandering, the energy consumption barely drops. In some regions, it actually increases.
Which is not what you'd expect from a system that's supposedly taking a smoke break.
Well, not exactly, but right. The neuroscientist Marcus Reichle at WashU basically discovered this by accident in the late 90s. He and his team were doing PET and fMRI studies, and they needed baseline control states, just have people lie there with their eyes closed, not doing any specific task. And they kept seeing this consistent pattern of brain regions that lit up during rest and dampened down when people engaged in focused external tasks. At first they thought it was noise, then they realized they'd stumbled onto something fundamental.
This became the default mode network.
Though Reichle himself has said he kind of regrets the name because it implies a passivity that's misleading. The default mode network, or DMN, includes the medial prefrontal cortex, the posterior cingulate cortex, the angular gyrus, and the medial temporal lobes, including the hippocampus. And it's not just one thing that turns on and off. It's a highly interconnected set of regions that activate in a coordinated way when your attention detaches from the external environment and turns inward.
This is the daydreaming engine.
It's part of it, but it's more accurate to say the DMN is the infrastructure for self-generated thought. That includes daydreaming, but also remembering the past, imagining the future, thinking about other people's mental states, moral reasoning, constructing personal narratives. The common thread is what researchers call stimulus, independent thought, cognition, that's decoupled from immediate sensory input.
Which makes me wonder, you said the energy consumption barely drops. What's it actually doing with all that fuel?
There was a fascinating study out of the University of British Columbia a few years ago. They found that when people engage in mind wandering, the brain is essentially running simulations. It's constructing hypothetical scenarios, replaying social interactions, mentally rehearsing future conversations. The DMN doesn't just generate random mental content, it's integrating information from episodic memory, semantic knowledge, and social cognition to build coherent internal narratives.
The brain is basically running a flight simulator for life.
That's actually a really good way to put it, and there's evidence this serves an adaptive function. Jerome Singer, who basically founded the modern study of daydreaming back at Yale in the 60s, identified what he called positive constructive daydreaming. This playful, wishful, imagery-rich mental activity that correlates with creativity, planning ability, and even emotional regulation. He distinguished it from what he called guilty, dysphoric daydreaming, which is more obsessive and anxiety-driven.
So not all mind-wandering is created equal. But before we go deeper into that, I want to get back to Daniel's core question about whether this shares anything with nighttime dreaming. Because intuitively, they feel similar. You're not fully present. Your mind is generating scenes that aren't real. There's a narrative quality to both.
That's where the neuroscience gets really counterintuitive. Because, at a superficial level, you might think yes. Both involve internally generated imagery and narrative. Both occur when you're decoupled from the external environment. But the brain states are almost opposite. During REM sleep, which is when most vivid narrative dreaming occurs, the default mode network is actually partially active, but in a very different configuration. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is involved in executive function and logical reasoning, is heavily downregulated. That's why in dreams you accept bizarre things without questioning them. You're flying through your childhood home that's also somehow a shopping mall, and you just go with it. But during daydreaming, the prefrontal cortex remains online. You're still capable of metacognition. You know you're daydreaming, and you can snap out of it if something demands your attention.
The difference is basically whether the brain's reality-checking department is open for business.
That's a big part of it. But there's also the neurochemical environment. REM sleep is characterized by high acetylcholine, very low serotonin, and norepinephrine. Daydreaming happens in a waking brain with normal aminergic tone. And the content differences follow from that. Dreams are more emotionally intense, more bizarre, more discontinuous. Daydreams tend to be more coherent, more socially grounded, more linear.
Even though daydreams can still be pretty weird.
Sure, but there's a qualitative difference, and here's where it gets really interesting. There is one state where the boundary between the two blurs, and that's the hypnagogic period, the transition between wakefulness and sleep. People often report vivid, dreamlike imagery during that window, and the brain's networks are in a kind of hybrid configuration. Some researchers think this might be the closest thing to a shared mechanism.
If someone's drifting off in a meeting and they're in that half-asleep zone, what's happening in their brain shares more with actual dreaming than someone who's fully awake and just mentally redecorating their apartment?
Yeah, that's a good distinction. The fully awake daydreamer is in DMN-dominant but waking state mode. The person drifting towards sleep is entering a transitional neurochemical state, and the person in REM is in a fundamentally different brain state altogether.
Let me pull on something you mentioned earlier. The simulation function. If daydreaming is the brain running scenarios, is there any evidence this actually improves real-world performance? Or is it just mental junk food?
No, there's genuine evidence for functional benefits. Researchers at the University of California, Santa Barbara, did work on what they called creative incubation. They'd give people a demanding creative task, then insert a break with an undemanding task that allowed mind wandering, something like a simple reaction time exercise. The people whose minds wandered during that break performed significantly better when they returned to the creative problem. But here's the key, it only worked if the mind wandering was about something other than the problem. If you kept consciously ruminating on the task, you didn't get the benefit.
You have to actually let go.
You have to let the DMN do its associative work without the prefrontal cortex trying to micromanage the process. It's like, you can't force insight. The network needs the freedom to make loose associations, to pull together memories and concepts that aren't obviously connected. And that's something the focused, task-positive network isn't designed to do.
This connects to something I've noticed, which is that my best ideas tend to arrive when I'm doing something completely unrelated. Showering, walking, staring out a window. There's almost an inverse relationship between how hard I'm trying and how good the insight is.
That's a well-documented phenomenon. It's sometimes called the shower effect in the literature, and it maps directly onto DMN function. When you disengage from focused attention, the DMN becomes more active, and it's uniquely suited to making those remote associations that feel like sudden insights.
All those teachers who told me to stop staring out the window were actually suppressing my cognitive development.
They might have been suppressing your creativity anyway. Though there's a balance, you do also need periods of focused attention to actually execute on insights. The DMN and the task-positive network are kind of like a seesaw. When one is active, the other tends to dampen, and healthy cognition involves fluid switching between them.
Which brings me to individual variation. Daniel mentioned this in his prompt, the spectrum from idle mind wandering to immersive fantasy. Some people seem to live in elaborate internal worlds, and others barely daydream at all. What's driving those differences?
This is where it gets really fascinating, and also where the clinical literature intersects with the neuroscience. There's a construct called fantasy proneness, first described by Cheryl Wilson and Theodore Barber in the early 80s. They identified a small subset of the population, roughly 4%, who report extremely vivid, immersive fantasy lives. These are people who as children had imaginary companions that felt nearly real, who can become so absorbed in a daydream that they lose track of their surroundings, who experience their imagined scenarios with almost sensory intensity.
4% is not trivial. That's about 1 in 25 people.
And the more recent construct is maladaptive daydreaming, which was first described by Eli Sommer at the University of Haifa in 2002. He noticed a pattern in patients who were using daydreaming as a form of experiential avoidance. They'd spend hours a day in elaborate fantasy worlds, often triggered by music or movement, and it was interfering with their real-world functioning. The content tends to be highly structured, almost like an ongoing internal television series with recurring characters and plot lines.
Is this recognized as a clinical diagnosis?
Not yet in the DSM or ICD, but there's a growing body of research. There's a validated assessment tool called the Maladaptive Daydreaming Scale, the MDS-16, and studies using it have found prevalence estimates suggesting it may affect somewhere around 2.5% of the general population. The neuroimaging work is still early, but there's some evidence of heightened DMN connectivity in maladaptive daydreamers. Their default mode network seems to be more tightly coupled, more prone to dominating conscious experience.
It's almost like the seesaw you described is stuck on one side.
That's one hypothesis. The normal fluid switching between DMN and task-positive networks might be impaired, and there are interesting overlaps with other conditions. Maladaptive daydreaming frequently co-occurs with ADH, D, with obsessive-compulsive tendencies, and with histories of childhood trauma or social isolation. Though it's important to say that not everyone with a rich fantasy life has a problem. Many highly creative people have vivid daydreams that enhance their lives and work.
The boundary between trait and pathology is always messier than the diagnostic manuals would like it to be.
And that's especially true here, because daydreaming exists on multiple spectrums: frequency, vividness, controllability, content type, functional impact. You can be a frequent daydreamer whose daydreams are positive and under your control, and that's associated with creativity and emotional well-being. Or you can be a frequent daydreamer whose daydreams feel compulsive and interfere with your life, and that's a different thing entirely.
What about the other end of the spectrum? People who report very little daydreaming. Is that even possible, or are they just not noticing it?
There's a condition called aphantasia, which is the inability to generate voluntary mental imagery. People with aphantasia don't see things in their mind's eye. When you tell them to imagine an apple, they know what an apple is conceptually, but they don't experience any visual representation of one, and it turns out this has implications for daydreaming. Many people with aphantasia report that their mind wandering is more verbal or conceptual. It's not that they don't have internally generated thought, but it doesn't take the form of visual scenes.
That's hard for me to imagine. No pun intended. When I drift off, it's very visual. I'm seeing places, faces, scenarios.
That's the norm for most people, but it's not universal. The discovery of aphantasia is actually pretty recent. Adam Zeman at the University of Exeter first described it in the scientific literature in 2015, though the phenomenon itself had been noted anecdotally for much longer. And it raises a really interesting question about what daydreaming even is. If your internal experience is primarily verbal or abstract, is that still daydreaming, or is it something else?
I'd say it's on the same spectrum, just a different sensory modality.
I think that's right. And the DMN activation patterns in aphantasic individuals do seem to be broadly similar to those with typical imagery, which suggests the network is doing similar cognitive work. Memory integration, future simulation, social cognition, just without the visual component.
Let's circle back to the nighttime dreaming comparison, because I want to push on something. You said the brain states are almost opposite, and I get the neurochemistry argument. But there's also the content question. Dreams often incorporate elements from recent waking experience, the day residue effect, and daydreams also draw on memory. Is there any evidence that the same memory consolidation processes are at work?
This is where the story gets more nuanced. Memory consolidation during sleep, particularly during slow-wave sleep, not REM, involves the hippocampus replaying recent experiences and the neocortex extracting patterns and integrating them into existing knowledge structures. That's a specific, sleep-dependent process. Daydreaming doesn't do that kind of systems consolidation.
It does something with memory.
Yes, but it's a different process. Daydreaming seems to be involved in what memory researchers call schema activation. It pulls up related memories and knowledge and recombines them in novel ways. It's less about consolidating what happened today, and more about building hypothetical scenarios from the raw materials of your accumulated experience. Which is why daydreaming tends to be future-oriented. Something like 60 to 70% of daydream content is about future events or hypothetical situations, not about the past.
That's a striking number. So daydreaming is fundamentally prospective, and dreaming is more about processing what's already happened.
With an important caveat, dreams do have prospective elements too, but the balance is different, and the emotional processing function seems different as well. There's a theory, most associated with Rosalind Cartwright and later Matthew Walker, that REM sleep serves an emotional recalibration function. It helps strip the emotional charge from memories, particularly negative ones, so you can retain the information without the same level of distress. Daydreaming doesn't seem to do that kind of emotional processing. If anything, certain types of daydreaming, the guilty dysphoric kind Singer described, can amplify negative emotion.
Because you're rehearsing the thing that's bothering you, rather than processing it.
You're spinning your wheels in the same emotional rut. And that's one of the clinical concerns with maladaptive daydreaming. It can function as avoidance that ultimately makes the underlying problem worse.
If someone's spending a lot of time in daydreams that are anxious or obsessive, the advice might be to actually engage more with the external world, rather than trusting that the mind wandering is doing useful work.
That's consistent with the clinical guidance. The healthy pattern seems to be flexible switching. You can go into DMN dominant mind wandering when the situation allows, and you can come back out when you need to. The problem is rigidity in either direction.
What about the role of external triggers? I've noticed certain things reliably send me into daydream mode. Long drives, repetitive tasks, certain kinds of music. Is there a consistent pattern in what triggers DMN activation?
The common factor seems to be what researchers call low perceptual demand. When the external environment doesn't require much processing, you're on a familiar route, doing a routine task, listening to music you've heard 100 times, the brain's attentional resources are freed up, and the DMN becomes more dominant. This is actually why a lot of people report their most creative insights during activities like showering or walking. The sensory input is just engaging enough to keep the task-positive network lightly occupied, but not so demanding that it suppresses the DMN.
It's like the brain needs a fidget spinner to keep one part of itself busy while the other part does the interesting work.
That's a surprisingly apt analogy. And there's some neuroimaging work that supports this. When people are given a very simple, undemanding task, the DMN is actually more active than during pure rest, possibly because the light external engagement prevents the mind from going completely blank and actually facilitates the kind of free associative thought that characterizes productive daydreaming.
Absolute boredom isn't the sweet spot. You want mild boredom.
Mild, structured boredom, which, by the way, is increasingly hard to come by in a world of smartphones and constant notifications. There's a real concern among some cognitive researchers that we're systematically eliminating the conditions that enable productive mind wandering.
Because you reach for your phone the moment there's a gap.
And that moment of potential DMN activation gets replaced by task-positive network engagement with whatever you're scrolling through. The brain never gets those micro-breaks where the associative machinery can do its work.
I feel personally attacked.
I'm not naming names.
You don't have to. Let me ask something about the development angle. Do children daydream differently than adults? Is the DMN fully developed early on, or does it mature?
The DMN undergoes significant development through childhood and adolescence. In very young children, the network isn't fully integrated. The different nodes don't communicate with each other as efficiently. As kids get older, the DMN becomes more coherent, and its anti-correlation with the task-positive network becomes stronger. That developmental trajectory continues through adolescence and into early adulthood.
Which tracks with the kind of daydreaming kids do versus adults. A 5-year-old's fantasy life seems more fragmented, more immediate, less structured around long-term planning.
And the content of daydreams shifts with age in predictable ways. Young children's fantasies are more about play and immediate wish fulfillment. Adolescents' daydreams become more social. They're heavily populated with peers, with scenarios about status and belonging. And adult daydreams, on average, become more pragmatic. More about planning, problem-solving, navigating real-world challenges.
Though the fantasy-prone individuals you mentioned earlier seem to retain that more elaborate, immersive style into adulthood.
And it's not necessarily a bad thing. Many highly creative adults, novelists, filmmakers, game designers, essentially get paid to elaborate their daydreams into structured works. The boundary between adaptive and maladaptive is really about whether it enriches your life or replaces it.
That's a good distinction. So where does the science stand right now on the daydreaming versus dreaming question? If you had to summarize the consensus, or the lack of consensus...
I'd say the consensus is that they're distinct phenomena that share some superficial features, but operate on fundamentally different neural and neurochemical foundations. The DMN is central to daydreaming, but only partially and differently involved in dreaming. The neurochemical environments are essentially opposite. High acetylcholine and low monoamines during REM, normal waking neurochemistry during daydreaming. The cognitive features are different. Metacognition is preserved in daydreaming, severely impaired in dreaming. Content is different. Daydreams are more coherent, more future-oriented, less bizarre. Memory function is different. Sleep-dependent consolidation versus waking schema activation.
The short answer to Daniel's question is no. They're not the same mechanism.
They're not the same mechanism, but they're also not completely unrelated. They both involve internally generated mental content that's decoupled from immediate sensory input. They both draw on memory and construct narrative scenarios. It's just that the underlying machinery doing the construction is configured very differently in each state.
The hypnagogic state you mentioned is the interesting border territory.
And there's also been some interesting work on lucid dreaming, where the dreamer becomes aware they're dreaming and can sometimes control the dream content. In lucid dreams, the prefrontal cortex becomes more active. It's almost like the dream state acquires some of the metacognitive features of waking daydreaming, which further supports the idea that prefrontal engagement is the key differentiator.
If you're in a dream and you realize you're dreaming, your brain is essentially dragging the dream a little closer to a daydream in terms of its neural configuration.
That's exactly the hypothesis, and it's supported by EEG and fMRI studies of lucid dreamers showing increased gamma band activity in frontal regions during lucid episodes. It's a hybrid state.
Which makes me wonder about the reverse. Can daydreaming ever become dreamlike enough that you lose the metacognitive awareness?
That's essentially what happens in the most extreme forms of maladaptive daydreaming, or in certain dissociative states. The boundary isn't perfectly sharp. And when people are sleep-deprived or in monotonous conditions, they can experience what are called microsleeps, with dreamlike intrusions into waking consciousness.
Right. The classic long-distance driver seeing things that aren't there.
And that's a genuine safety concern. But it's a different mechanism from normal daydreaming. It's actual sleep onset intruding into waking, not just intense DMN activity.
One more thing I want to touch on before we wrap. You mentioned earlier that the DMN was discovered partly by accident. Has the research moved beyond just identifying the network to actually understanding how its different nodes communicate during daydreaming?
Yeah, the field has gotten much more sophisticated. Researchers now use techniques like dynamic functional connectivity to look at how the coupling between DMN regions changes over time, not just whether the network is on or off. And what they're finding is that daydreaming isn't one uniform state. Different patterns of DMN connectivity correspond to different types of self-generated thought. Mind wandering about the past looks different from mind wandering about the future. Social daydreaming looks different from solitary fantasy. It's a much more granular picture than we had even 10 years ago.
The network isn't just a single thing that activates. It's more like a set of chords that can be played in different configurations.
That's a good way to think about it. And the specific chord being played determines the quality of the internal experience. Some configurations are associated with creative insight, others with rumination. The same network can produce very different mental states depending on how its components are interacting and what other networks it's communicating with.
Presumably, this is where individual differences show up. Some people's DMN is just wired to play certain chords more readily than others.
That's the emerging picture. And it's probably both trait and state. There are stable individual differences in DMN connectivity that correlate with things like creativity and fantasy proneness, but there are also moment-to-moment fluctuations that depend on mood, fatigue, context, and what you were just doing.
If Daniel's asking what daydreaming means, the answer seems to be that it's not one thing. It's a whole category of internal experience, served by a specific brain network, but expressed in wildly different ways across individuals and situations.
That's actually the scientifically honest answer. The pop science version is your brain has a daydreaming network and it does creative stuff. The real version is messier and more interesting. The DMN is a fundamental part of how the human brain generates a self, a continuous sense of who you are across time, integrating your past, your possible futures, your social world. Daydreaming is one expression of that deeper function. And its relationship to nighttime dreaming is real but indirect. They're different instruments playing in different keys, even if they sometimes sound like they're in the same orchestra.
I like that. Though now I'm going to be self-conscious every time I catch myself staring out a window.
You should be. Your DMN is showing.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1902, the Mont Pelee eruption on Martinique released a nude ardente, a pyroclastic flow, containing gases measured at roughly 700 degrees Celsius. If you convert that to the old Réaumur scale still used in parts of the French Empire at the time, it comes to about 560 degrees Réaumur. The Réaumur scale set the freezing point of water at 0 and boiling at 80, which means a pyroclastic flow at 700 Celsius would register well past the scale's upper limit, the equivalent of trying to measure a volcano's heat on a thermometer designed for cheese production.
I don't know what to do with the cheese production detail.
I think that was the point.
Here's what I'm left with. Daydreaming turns out to be this essential cognitive activity that we've culturally dismissed as laziness, when it might actually be one of the things that makes human cognition distinctively powerful. This ability to decouple from the present and simulate possible futures. And we're now living in a technological environment that's systematically squeezing out the conditions that make it possible. That feels like something worth paying attention to.
We've built devices that demand constant focused attention, and we're only now realizing that the unfocused state we've been eliminating might be crucial for the very creativity and problem-solving we claim to value.
Something to daydream about, anyway. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com. We're back next time.
Take it easy.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.